to order. I'd like to welcome all of you. This morning I want to thank General Britt and General Byrne both for welcoming us here today. I'd like to welcome Representative Galluzio. Thank you for coming by. He is a representative in this legislative district, so we're glad he's here. He's going to be with us for a while. We are going to start this morning with Senate Bill 18, and we're privileged to have the President of the Senate join us this morning. And he wanted to just come forward and, in his own testimony, introduce Senate Bill 18. Gee, I've got about a half an inch wide crack from here straight out into the parking lot, and I can see Senator Starr jogging across the parking lot. So I'm going to wait for just a minute. It's good that everybody can be with us. I'm sure Senator George is probably following MapQuest, which is not the way to get here, most of us discovered, unless you want to drive down a very big rutted street. Okay. What I guess I should do is open a public hearing on both 18 and 19. So let's open a hearing on both Senate Bills 18 and 19, which are brought to us by Senator Courtney. Senator Courtney, could you come forward, please? We're not used to such big, comfortable chairs there, Senator, so you have to be careful navigating them. But again, the armory has been very kind to us. Yes, that one. Maybe it has a trap door under it. I'm not sure. I can't tell from here, sir.
Thank you, Chair Shields, and members of the Senate General Government Committee, and Representative Lizella. My name is Peter Courtney, and I live at 2925 Island View Drive North, and that's in Salem, 97303. I happen to be a state senator, District 11, and that's parts of Salem, Jervis, and Woodburn. And I'm here today to speak in support of Senate Bills 18 and 19. These bills were pre-session filed at the request of the Senate Interim Committee on General Government. They were good enough to introduce them as committee bills, and I was privileged to testify for the committee last June in support of this very legislation, and appreciate the opportunity allowing me to come here today and to testify again in support of them. It is very appropriate that today, entitled as part of the Senate's effort to take the legislative process outside the Capitol to the people of Oregon, this committee consider legislation that would honor and support those Oregonians from communities across the state who are making the tremendous sacrifices on behalf of all of us. These bills are the first of many that you are likely to consider this session, whose purpose is to provide financial support to families in our state who are bearing the tremendous burden of having fathers, mothers, sons, and daughters called to active duty. I'm pleased to announce that the Speaker of the House and I have jointly introduced several bills that will extend a variety of benefits, ranging from hardship grants for families of National Guard members away on active duty who are experiencing financial difficulties, to supplemental injury and death benefits, to public university tuition waivers for survivors of guardspersons killed in service. I look forward to the opportunity to discuss those bills further in the future. I am now sort of giving you a plethora of other bills that have been introduced as well, and it'll be with you and your deference and your wisdom, collective wisdom, will decide whether or not we hear those bills or what you want to do with them. So I serve at your pleasure as well as those, but I'm just quickly outlining a host of other bills that will be coming in. SB 18, which is the first bill up, relates to Oregon's taxation of survivor death benefits for military families. For nearly a century, the federal government has paid a death gratuity to families of soldiers who are killed in the line of duty. This has never been more than a token, and that is the word I will use. This has never been more than a token. And I say that for this reason. This is surprising, at least to me. To give you some perspective, Congress doubled the benefit in 2003 to $12,000. I'll say no more. The amount of the benefit does not begin to compensate the families for their sacrifice. To be sure, no amount of money could. To make matters worse, however, the death benefit that families receive is currently taxable by the state of Oregon. In 2003, Congress, to their credit, amended federal tax law to provide that the death benefit would no longer be taxable, at least by the federal government. Under Oregon law, only the first $2,000 is tax-free. Senate Bill 18 would change Oregon's law to make it consistent with federal law to exempt the federal military death benefit from state income tax. This will ensure that we are not raising state revenue on the backs of those families who have already made the ultimate sacrifice for fellow Oregonians, for our communities, and for all of this country. This measure is made retroactive to the 2001 tax year in order to provide relief to the families of those Oregonians who have already given their lives in combat service since September 11, 2001. Including the nine members of the Oregon National Guard who have died in Iraq and Iran. This is a worthwhile and overdue piece of legislation. Please note, my fellow legislators, this is not Peter's bill. This is a committee bill. Please note that. It was introduced as a committee bill. It is not Peter's bill. Senate Bill 19. Senate Bill 19 is broader than Senate Bill 18 and would exempt from Oregon income tax the active duty pay earned by National Guard members and reservists who are called to active duty but remain stationed in Oregon. This may surprise you, although looking at this august group of great people, you probably already know this. It is not terribly common for a guardsman and reservist to be in this situation, called to active duty and yet stationed in the state of Oregon. Last year, the military department estimated that this legislation would not affect more than a few dozen people at any one time. But Senate Bill 19 is a matter of simple equity. It will change Oregon's tax laws to exempt the income of Oregonians who put their lives and jobs on hold in order to fulfill their active duty obligation and then by sheer luck of a draw are assigned to federal duty in Oregon and therefore pay Oregon taxes while other soldiers from the same unit are assigned to duty across the river, i.e. Washington, Idaho, or whatever, and therefore pay no Oregon taxes. So I hope you understand what I'm saying. The federal government, once they're federalized, they go on duty and they happen to be stationed here in Oregon, not a lot of them, they get taxed. If the same thing happens in Washington, they don't get taxed in terms of state tax laws. This proposal was contained in Senate Bill 231, which was passed by the Oregon Senate near the end of our 2000 session, but did not receive a full vote in the House before we signed and died in that extraordinary 2003 session. I say extraordinary, but I won't describe what I mean by extraordinary. Conclusion. Oregonians serving in the military and the thousands of men and women in our National Guard and reservists provide an incredible service for our state and now for our country. Senate Bill 1819 are the last least that we can do to recognize their sacrifice, and I hope and expect that we will do much more before this session is over. Again, thank you for even allowing me to come here today. Thank you for even allowing me to testify today. And I also brought with me, in case I don't know all the details, because I always feel a bit nervous before any committee, particularly this committee, I brought with me Chris Garrett, one of my extraordinary members of my staff, outstanding human being who is doing his public service by taking leave from a major law firm at little or no pay, because that's the way it is, to take care of me on legal matters. Thank you. That is the end of my official statement. I believe, I hope, you have my written testimony in front of you, or I have violated one of the cardinal rules. bring 50 copies of written testimony.
Believe me, we've got your testimony. I would comment that since you have mentioned being nervous in front of this or any committee, I'm sure it's a mutual kind of thing, because every time you come in front of one of our committees, we're all nervous that the president would be in front of us. So we can also hear nervously together, something like that. I do have a couple questions, and I'm sure others might as well. Senator, you made reference to the fact that Senate Bill 19 would only affect a couple dozen people, most likely. I was wondering how many would be affected by Senate Bill 18, and if you don't have an answer, maybe some others might have some estimates at least, and probably what the amount of money would be, since we're looking at the amount of money related to every cotton-picking bill in the legislature these days.
Well, I believe in my testimony, if I'm not mistaken, we have lost 9 members of the National Guard at this time, so for sure... I've just been told, in case you wonder who I'm talking to, I need to identify that. The Lieutenant Colonel, Major General Mike Caldwell, I think I've covered all his ranks, has indicated we have 10 individuals now, sadly, that this bill would apply to as I speak to you.
Yeah, and all this time I thought he was just a major nuisance.
I believe it's 10. Now, what I can't tell you, that's the answer to the first question, Chair Shield. What I can't tell you is the amount of money. I don't have those estimates as I talk to you right now.
Colonel Caldwell might, and I'm going to ask him to come.
Well, yeah, okay. That's really good. That's good that he's come up here, certainly.
For the record, my name is Colonel Mike Caldwell.
I thought he had promoted you there.
Well, he did. He motivated and promoted me to a major general's office.
So
we cover the waterfront. I appreciate that, Senator. We have had 10 Oregon Guardsmen. Right now, the state of Oregon is approximately 30 individuals have died during this conflict in Iraq and or Iran. So they're probably on the, from this point, I would estimate around 30, 35 probably. Mm-hmm. We don't know where it's all going to end. Obviously, nobody does. And the cost right now, the Senator is absolutely correct. It was raised from $6,000 to $12,000. There is discussion about raising it further in this Congress for that death benefit. But that remains to be seen.
Okay. So the, like I'm talking about the $12,000, I know it would vary, but on average, refund checks or whatever back to 2001, for Oregon, nobody's really figured that out on average, or is there a fiscal... Maybe
Mr. Chairman,
I'd be intuitive to comment on that as
well. Go ahead. Roughly, we have not done a fiscal, but the Senator was accurate again when he said that there's a $3,000 exemption currently for federal military pay if it's earned outside the state of Oregon. If it's earned inside the state of Oregon, it's not exempted on that $3,000. So you could factor $9,000 times the 30 and take 9% of that, and that's your fiscal impact. Pretty small.
Judith. I'm just catching up here. Judith has a little bit of information for us, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, on both Senate Bill 18 and Senate Bill 19, we have received a minimal fiscal impact from the fiscal office, and because both bills do have a subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee, we do have just a potential revenue impact slip that sends this then on to revenue. So that's, for the record, those are the impact statements we have. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have just informed by my very learned high staff that we estimate it's about $450 per person of revenue that would not be coming in.
Which is very minimal considering the sacrifices that these men and women are making. Are there other questions from the panel this morning? Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. President, do you know, I believe I understand, this death benefit is only paid to the men and women who die while in active service. So this is not a death benefit paid to them after they're discharged.
Chair Shields, Senator Walker, Chair of Education and Workforce, it is my understanding that is correct.
Okay. And my second question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Is Congress, you indicated Congress in 2003 exempted this death benefit from taxes. So prior to that time, had Congress been taxing the entire amount?
My understanding, yes, ma'am.
That's correct. It's my understanding. Chair Shields, Senator Walker, it's my understanding the answer is absolutely yes.
Thank you, Mr. President and Mr. Chair.
Are there other questions? Is there a question from Senator George, who needs to be invited up to the front row and not sit back there in the back anonymously or whatever he's doing?
No question. You put a Marine and farmer in the car, and we've got
to argue
about how to get here, so
we will. I see. Well, you're still welcome to come up and join us, sir.
I do hope there's not a reflection on the Marine.
I wanted to go to McDonald's, so that's what they have for
I see.
So you didn't feed me. I want something to eat.
I see. But I already blamed MapQuest for you being late, because if you followed MapQuest, you ended up on the bumpiest road in Tiger.
We were down that one too, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Any other questions? I'm going to let you gentlemen step back and ask, we don't have anybody signed up for testimony on either one of these bills, but if there's anybody in the audience that would like to make a comment, I would certainly like to invite you. General, please share with us for a moment. You can even keep the Major General or whatever he is sitting there beside you.
Mike is an indispensable individual in my staff. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would like to make comments on three areas. And
Could you just give us your name for the record?
For the record, this is I am Brigadier General Raymond Byrne, the acting Adjutant General for the Oregon National Guard. And with me today is Colonel Mike Caldwell, my Deputy Director. And I'd like to make comments on three areas. The first one is Senate Joint Resolution 1. The second is Senate Bill 18. And the third one is Senate Bill 19.
Right now we just have a hearing going on 18 and 19. Can you make your comments on those? And then maybe I'll slip in a quick hearing on the other to fit into your schedule.
Thank you very much. First comment will be on testimony for Senate Bill 18. Senate Bill 18 is an important change in the Oregon tax law in that it provides that any benefit paid by the federal government under Section 134 of the IRS code could be non-taxable for an Oregon recipient. This is specifically directed at what is commonly known as the death benefit that is given to a spouse upon the death of a soldier that is involved in a declared war or hostile action. By connecting to the federal IRS code, in the event that Congress increases this benefit, it will automatically cover this legislation. I know that I don't need to remind you, any of us in this Army today, but we in the Oregon National Guard have suffered 10 soldiers killed since our deployment to Iraq. Most recently, earlier this week, a soldier died. In the state alone, we are over 30 members in the armed forces have lost their lives since September 11, 2001. As we speak today, the death benefit is $12,000. There's been talk in Congress, as you have heard, of raising this sum, but that remains to be seen. I would urge you passage of this bill. Thank you, and I'll answer any questions.
Are there any questions for General on this bill? Okay, let's move on to 19.
Senate Bill 19 will correct an inequity that occurred when our 1249th Engineer Battalion, as they were mobilized for federal duty in Iraq in 2002. After that unit was placed on federal active duty, it was determined that they were not needed in the combat zone, and they were subsequently assigned Fort Lewis to backfill for a similar active unit that had been deployed. During that year, the battalion was assigned subsequent missions at Yakima Firing Center and Unitil Firing Depot in eastern Oregon. Unbeknownst to us, we discovered that once a small portion of the battalion, one company of 125 soldiers, was assigned to duty in Oregon at the depot, those wages earned became taxable, even though they were on federal active duty. While at the same time, by luck of the draw, their fellow soldiers across the river in Washington received tax-free wages. Unfortunately, We did not discover this situation until closing days of the 2003 legislative session, and as discussed by the President, we attempted to get a bill similar to this one today through the legislature prior to its close. Senate acted swiftly, but unfortunately the bill died on the Speaker's desk in the last day. Senator Courtney committed to reintroducing this at the first opportunity, which has been done, and we are grateful for his efforts. I might also add that Governor Pulongoski directed the Revenue Department to not collect those taxes from those affected guardsmen until the legislature has had the opportunity to act on this matter. I would ask for your swift passage of Senate Bill 19, and again, I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions? Yes, Senator Verger.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask a general question that would not be specifically to either one of the bills.
Okay.
Is that permissible? All right.
I'll grant that. Go ahead.
Or would you rather...
Go ahead.
All right. Brigadier General Byrne, I'm asking a question that a lot of constituents are asking me, and that is the concern of the number of Oregon National Guard that are being sent to a foreign country when we could have a natural disaster in our own state. And there is some concern. Do you feel that Oregon is providing, percentage-wise, about what other states are providing as far as military that is being sent to Iraq? Or do you feel that the Oregon National Guard has, for the size of our state, a larger percentage of National Guard members going? And what do you what would you comment on the necessity of how many men and women that we need in Oregon in case we would have a natural disaster?
Senator Berger, I hear three questions. The first question is, do we have enough soldiers and airmen in the state of Oregon to take care of any disaster that we may potentially have? The second question is, as the percentage of soldiers and airmen being sent out of Oregon at odds with maybe what other states would have to be involved with, and the third one would be I guess I'll answer those two, and if there's a third, there's two.
Okay.
On the first one, the answer, we do have enough soldiers and airmen to take care of any disaster that we potentially could have at this point in time. Primarily over the last 10 years, we have been involved with flood relief and also with fires. We always do a planning session prior to fire season to ensure that we have assets available and personnel available based upon the current rainfall. We've already pushed that up and started looking at that. We currently have 25% of the Army Guard deployed, which leaves us 75% of the force, or approximately 4,500 soldiers and airmen, maybe up even to 5,000 to potentially to assist in any natural disaster in the state of Oregon, with about 1,500 deployed at this time. I feel that confidently we can fulfill any mission that the governor assigns or requests us to complete.
Mr. Chairman, follow up, please.
Yes, Senator
Murphy. I do have a third question. My third question would be, how do you think that this will affect the recruitment in the future of National Guardsmen who don't intend necessarily to be sent into combat as they have?
Madam Senator, the nature of the National Guard has changed dramatically over the last 3 years. My goal and the goal of the Oregon National Guard is that if soldiers or airmen decide to leave the Oregon National Guard for reasons other than those that we have control over, we will take care of families, we will take care of pay, we will take care of personnel actions, we will assist them in their pursuits of education. Anything that we have control over, I am committed, and the Oregon National Guard is committed, to ensure that we take care of those people. To date, I have, in the last several months when we've had interviews with individuals leaving the Guard, for those reasons, we have not had none. Conversely, reasons why individuals are getting out of the Guard at this point in time center around deployments, and with deployments, the ability to to predict when the deployments would occur. And those are becoming more predictable as time goes on as compared to 2 years ago. The second piece would be changes in their work status, as in they're being promoted and they have difficulty with that. The third, of course, is their families. Those are the reasons why we have people leaving this time.
Thank you very much, Mr. J.
Thank you. General, given what you've just said, can you give us some statistical data on numbers 3 years ago, numbers now? Have your numbers dropped in Oregon because of the changing role of the Guard?
I could give you some generalities and we can follow it up with specifics.
That would be helpful.
Okay. Just generalities, 3 years ago, recruitment, we were, 3 years ago we were meeting our goals. Currently we're approximately 30 behind, which is about 90% of what we normally have.
90% of your goals.
Of our goals. And part of that has to do with the efforts on behalf of the governor and the budget and the Senate as well as the House to add benefits to the National Guard. Those are all very helpful things that haven't been updated for years. And those are all definitely incentives for people to join the Guard and to remain in the Guard. So we're doing fairly well. Also, the National Guard Bureau has increased the number of recruiters we have in the state by about 12, which allows us to have more people to do so. Additionally, what we're doing is I have sent with the current battalion, the 2nd Battalion, about to come back to the Oregon here in about 60 days. It's been advertised as a recruiter, but it's recruiters are also retention people. And so specifically to answer any questions they may have about bonuses, about military schools that they may have upon completion of their tour, the Army has offered to allow people to remain on active duty, to extend and go to active duty schools rather than take a break in service that might disrupt their lives and their families. So there are lots of things that this retention NCO recruiter is doing in Iraq rather than just looking to recruit people. Currently, there's a $15,000 bonus that is available, non-taxable if it's taken while they are deployed. So if we get the paperwork done and done correctly, it will allow those people who are eligible to apply for that. It's just something where I'm being proactive and looking to take care of soldiers while they're in theater.
Thank you for the answers to those questions. I know that we only have you for a few minutes and you have to leave, and that's why I'm permitting certain questions. They're of interest to all of us, and so, you know, I'm wanting to pursue this a little bit. But I'm not sure that we had an answer to Senator Berger's second question. Did
About the state percentage.
I did not duck that. Let me answer that. The answer is,
maybe we can restate the question for the audience.
The restate the question is the number of soldiers and airmen out of the state of Oregon at odds with other states? And the answer is, there are states that are in worse shape than the state of Oregon. General Blum, who's the Chief of National Guard Bureau, a year ago at the Governor's Conference, submitted a plan that the National Guard would like to model for all states, basically to right-size each state in the United States with a menu of organizations that would allow for 25% of the soldiers and airmen to be deployed, 50% in a retrain for either federal or state missions, and a status of 50% of the status to be in that position, and then 25% to be on a train for potential federal missions. In the state of Oregon, we've been running anywhere from 25 to 30%. You take Idaho, which is primarily structured as a combat state, about 80% of their people are deployed at this time.
So it's 80% in Idaho, 25% here.
25%.
Are there states that are much lower than us? Bigger states that point, have a lower percentage?
At this point in time, we're probably, I would consider us an average. Mike, did you have something?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Colonel Mike Caldwell, I think if you get to the heart of your question is we've had a lot of deployments since 9/11 in the state of Oregon, and I think that's where you're headed with this, if I might try to presuppose. In Oregon National Guard, Army Guard, we've had about 70% of the Oregon National Guard has been deployed since September 11, 2001. And we've had lots of questions from the media and other folks saying, why is that? And is that more or less? And I would say in that respect, if you look at that period of time, we're probably up in the high number with the rest of the states. And there's good reasoning for that. First off, we have had a very good record with respect to the units that we've had in the state of Oregon being qualified. Our members were qualified. We had good strength, which means we had good recruiting, good retention. And we were also fortunate to be in higher priority units. Oregon was blessed with high priority units as opposed to low priority units. Now, in peacetime, the good news about that is you get the equipment to train with. You get full-time jobs to support it because you're a higher priority than somebody else. So that's all good news. Bad news is when it comes time for deployments and they're looking for people to do these things, they look out, say, who's got the new equipment, who's got the personnel, who's well-trained, and who's demonstrated themselves as a very, very good unit. And we've got a bunch of very good units.
Okay.
So we ended up being at the head of the line in that respect.
There's questions. I know that we only have you for a few minutes and you have to leave, and that's why I'm permitting some questions. They're of interest to all of us, and so, you know, I'm wanting to pursue this a little bit. But I'm not sure that we had an answer to Senator Verger's second question.
About the states,
about the
percentage.
I did not duck that. Let me answer that. The answer is,
maybe we should restate the question for the audience.
The restate question is the number of soldiers and airmen out of the state of Oregon at odds with other states? And the answer is, there are states that are in worse shape than the state of Oregon. General Blum, who's the Chief of National Guard Bureau, a year ago at the Governor's Conference, submitted a plan that the National Guard would like to model for all states, basically to right-size each state in the United States with a menu of organizations that would allow for 25% of the soldiers and airmen to be deployed, 50% in a retrain for either federal or state missions, and a status of 50% of the status to be in that position, and then 25% to be on a training for potential federal missions. In the state of Oregon, we've been running anywhere from 25 to 30%. You take Idaho, which is primarily structured as a combat state, about 80% of their people are deployed at this time.
So it's 80% in Idaho, 25% here.
25%.
Are there states that are much lower than us? Bigger states that have a lower percentage?
At this point in time, we're probably, I would consider us an average. Mike, did you have something?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Colonel Mike Caldwell, I think if you get to the heart of your question is we've had a lot of deployments since 9/11 in the state of Oregon, and I think that's where you're headed with this, if I might try to presuppose. In Oregon National Guard, Army Guard, we've had about 70% of the Oregon National Guard has been deployed since September 11, 2001. And we've had lots of questions from the media and other folks saying, why is that? And is that more or less? And I would say in that respect, if you look at that period of time, we were probably up in the high number with the rest of the states. and there's good reasoning for that. First off, we have had a very good record with respect to the units that we've had in the state of Oregon being qualified. Our members were qualified. We had good strength, which was, that means we had good recruiting, good retention. And we were also fortunate to be in higher priority units. Oregon was blessed with high priority units as opposed to low priority units. Now, in peacetime, the good news about that is you get the equipment to train with, you get full-time jobs to support it because you're a higher priority than somebody else. So that's all good news. Bad news is, when it comes time for deployments, and they're looking for people to do these things, they look out and say, who's got the new equipment, who's got the personnel, who's well-trained, and who's demonstrated themselves as a very, very good unit. And we've got a bunch of very good units.
Okay.
So we ended up being at the head of the line in that respect. As it all washes out over probably a five-year period, as the general indicated, the Guard Bureau's objective is to try to level that out so you don't have a big hit on one state and a minor hit on another state. So that's kind of how that all happened. So we're 25% now.
That's very helpful. Senator Starr has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for joining us this morning. I kind of have a general question, too, over this broad area. The question that I have is, as it relates to our deployed troops, most of them have left jobs behind. Is there anything in the law and the statute that requires that job be held in for them so when they return they have a place to come back to work?
Federal law covered under the USARA law basically states that a soldier is activated, or a soldier or anybody in the armed forces is activated, that job is protected until they're returned. Am I correct on that, Colonel Caldwell?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, not only that, we have statutory language in the state of Oregon. I think it's under ORS 408. And we also have duplicate coverage into that. It primarily deals with state active duty call-ups, but also talks about veterans reemployment rights and Veterans Department. Here it's 408, isn't it? Veterans reemployment. Yes, chapter 408 of the Oregon Revised Statutes. So we tried to keep it in sync with federal law, but the federal law does have, you know, overall coverage.
And one additional follow-up, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me what the average for an Oregon National Guard member, the average length of their deployment has been since 9/11?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, I'll go back to 2001. They were fairly shorter. They were shorter than they are now. The one that in particular was the 1st Battalion 186 Infantry, which went to the Sinai. They were gone total time approximately 1 year, and now it is about 18 months. And so the last several units that we have deployed have all been 18-month total deployments.
Thank you very much.
I believe Senator George has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. General, Mr. Caldwell, thank you for being here. During the mid-1990s, we had a substantial reduction by design in the total U.S. military force. And my understanding is some forces were diminished as much as two-thirds. Is that the real reason that we, in fact, are being called up? Because, in fact, there is not that substantial, what would be considered the traditional military strength?
Senator George, with the reductions that occurred in the 1990s were a result of the end of the Cold War and the necessity or the needed necessity that there was not a requirement for a large standing force. I'll do a little bit longer. The history of active duty forces in the United States, the period from 1945 to the end of the Cold War was an anomaly. Prior to that, when there was a major conflict, forces were raised and then reduced. Example, at the beginning of World War I, the Army was sitting at about 130,000. World War II, excuse me. With the reduction, it was natural to go for a cost saving to reduce the amount of actives with the dependence on the reserve forces. That's the way America has done it since its inception. As we sit here today and the dependence on the reserve forces, the National Guard and the Army and the reserve forces is in my mind is clearly fulfills the intent of the the framers of the Constitution, is that if we go to war, then we go to war as a nation versus an active duty force.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Do you have some questions? Go ahead, Senator Walker.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. John, I had an opportunity a few years back to go with the ESGR, the Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve, down to San Diego to tour the facilities and understand what that program provides for employers. Do you think that you could share that information with the committee so they understand what support is out there for these employers who are enduring these long gaps in employment with their employees?
Senator Walker, Mr. Chairman, the Employee Support the Guard and Reserve is a national program. It is a very active program in the state of Oregon, and it is an advocacy program for reservists. The program in the state of Oregon has done an exceptional job in outreach in visiting with employers, explaining them to them rights and responsibilities they have in relation to deployed people who are activated and deployed. The outreach program that you participated in is a yearly program that allows employers to go visit sites where soldiers, airmen, Navy, other reservists may go. And we also do that within the state with various units that go to annual training. The most recent one here was Mayor Potter recently went on an ESGR visit to the Portland Air Base less than 3 weeks ago. Was able to visit with the Air Force Reserve tanker unit up in Portland and also get briefed on those. Essentially what it is just a program to ensure that employers have the opportunity to understand what their rights and responsibilities are. And it is an outreach program, not a gotcha program. Did I answer your question?
Yes, you did, because I thought it was an excellent program, and I really appreciated the opportunity to see that firsthand, because I had different opinions about the military and its purpose and its role, and that really changed a lot of my thinking. And there were other folks on that particular tour who there were departments from the state of Oregon, because we have a lot of our reservists that are public employees, and it helped them understand exactly what you said, their rights and responsibilities and their duties.
And then the last part would be that it gives them a hands-on look at what people do when they are called to active duty or go to a reserve assignment. It is really a wonderful program.
ESGR.com.
ESGR.com.
As a member of the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Natural Resources, we've just spent 3 days listening to the Department of Forestry's budget and contemplating this summer's fire season and all the rest. And a question from that to you would have to do with the potential for geographic kind of dislocation. Mike would remember that back in 1993, the governor wanted to close some armories around the state. And I said, fine, if you want to close them in the metro area or where there's lots of them, you can maybe get away with having one or two closed here or there, but not out in the Burns area or somewhere else where, you know, that was a resource to respond to an emergency. You needed to have those locations. Because of all the deployments, the question then becomes, even though you say we have 25% to 30% deployed and we still have 50% or reserve, are they in the right areas, I guess becomes my question. You know, have we made some sections of the state a little more vulnerable to forest fires or other emergencies that may occur? Tsunamis is another one that kind of comes to your mind these days. Do you have comments on that in terms of geographics?
Mr. Chairman, when we have units deploy, we have also have rear detachments that maintain the armory and have various functions in it as a rear detachment. For example, the 3rd Battalion, 116th Cavalry, and Fox Troop and Golf Troop, 82nd Cavalry, all deployed. So, but we do have rear detachments that are located in those areas, and the Oregon National Guard, both Army and Air, are after short train-up in the fire season, for example, can move anywhere in the state of Oregon on short notice. We go to where the need is.
Short notice is therefore able to respond quickly to an emergency, it would one occur.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman. Did you have something else, Colonel Caldwell?
I just add, Mr. Chairman, that you're absolutely correct. East of the Cascades is basically devoid of what normally would be 6,700 soldiers, and 6,700 soldiers are in Iraq right now. So there's probably somewhere around, 100 soldiers left back over there, I would guess. They could respond immediately, but they're degraded. But we can move people rather rapidly. We don't lose all of our assets, which we don't anticipate doing. We'll have plenty of assets, and if we can't, we'll go rent buses. We've got plenty of ways to get there. So it's not going to be overnight, but it never has been overnight. We're not the first responder in any disaster. We're typically late coming in, and we're early going out. That's where we're that backup. So it's really up to that first responder to take care of that. If they can't, then that's why. But we prepare for that, too. We prepare logistics plans. We've got them prepared. We're working on the EACHs right now, so how do we get them there quickly?
Well, you've demonstrated already proactive thinking with regard to these eventualities, and I think that's what's important.
So we're working on that plan as we speak.
I'd like to ask if any of the senators or Representative Galizia have any more questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We heard recently about some companies that are going beyond the normal call of duty to honor those who are serving by providing a good percentage of their wages, all the benefits maintained for the families. Is there any place that we could go, like online, and find out who they are? I understand one of them was Hewlett-Packard, and I made a decision on a computer based upon that, and we bought an HP because we heard they were one of the ones that was being very generous with their support. Is there anything like that out there that you're aware of?
A one-stop, Senator George, one-stop shop type of location where we can get that. I do not have that information to you at this point in time, but there are many organizations. Recently, this week I presented an award to Providence Hospital that they received a National Guard Association Award for their support. They have approximately 40 reservists that work for them. And they received the highest award, the National Guard, the Patrick Henry Award, for their support to the reserves. Of course, there are other state, federal agencies as well as local businesses that have done a superb job. Have gone above and beyond. Nike is another one that comes to mind. But what we can do is we will go through and we'll scrub a list for you of organizations that have done an exceptional job.
I appreciate Senator George's question. In fact, not only would I like to see that list put together or a website or whatever, but we should find some way to draw attention to an honor roll such employers. Maybe we could do that through a memorial, Senator, of some
That's
sort.
Exactly what I'm thinking about.
Have a memorial, have a press conference, have an honor roll, and if you could, Mike, maybe you could work with me. We could put that kind of thing together to benefit all of those that have jobs and find themselves deployed overseas. And
yes, sir.
It would be a good way to, without raising taxes, to enhance their benefits and the quality of life of their families.
We've had numerous examples. Home Depot's another one that comes to mind, and they have. They've gone way overboard in order to try to assist the families.
And I think that they need to be publicly appreciated, and we can help in that process.
And we're very grateful for that.
I would like to, going back to Senator Walker's comment earlier about the place for the Guard and Reserve, the state of Oregon, Governor Kunigoski in the state of Oregon, was recently selected for the ESGR award, highest award for the state of Oregon, which is the Pro Patria Award. And I would like to thank both the governor as well as both houses the Senate and the House to for their support that they've given us. It's because of your support that the Employees for Guard and Reserve selected the state of Oregon for that very prestigious award. Thank you.
I might add, just in that vein, talking about those benefit packages, and it was actually, I don't know if the President's still here or not.
No, the President has had to hurry back to say
okay, well, he was instrumental last session in working a piece of legislation that many people signed on to allow for the state of Oregon to offer health benefit packages to the soldiers who are deployed. So Senator Courtney was a main instigator in that, and that's a part of the law today, and state agencies do that for deployed guardsmen and reservists. And they can get it for 1 year. So that's a huge benefit. Of course, at the time, I think we thought that most of these deployments would be 1 year, and now they're 18 months. So. Yeah. But it's still a big benefit. And the interesting thing about it is we don't have absolute empirical data, but we've gotten responses back that there's only very few people using them because they have federal insurance. But the ones that are using it have particular oddball kind of necessities. Children that have certain disabilities or whatever that require certain types of training medication or whatever. And by switching over that federal system, it became very problematic. And that's why they can stay with the caregiver who they've been accustomed to having. And there's just one or two places that they've used it, and the rest of them just switch over to the federal TRICARE and then negotiate that maze. So it hasn't been a big impact, but it's certainly been a great value.
Mr. Chairman?
Thank you.
Do we, Carter, do we need to modify that original language to include for the total time of deployment? Because if it is 1 year, we're now looking at so many at 18 months.
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, I guess certainly it would be your option. I didn't throw it out there just for that reason. I wasn't trying to fish here, but it would certainly be a benefit to those deployed guardsmen and reservists who are state employees and local government as well. They have the option, local government does.
Mike, could you meet with Judith and myself to further pursue a possible amendment?
Yes, sir. And, Mr. Chairman, we have some legislation that we could probably, it's coming through right now, that might be able to be amended to take care of that. So.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. That's what I'm thinking.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Any
questions? Representative Gleason.
First of all, thank you for the opportunity.
Sure.
Aside from being a representative, I teach at Portland Community College, so I'm always interested in higher ed. I've had a lot of students who are guard members, et cetera, and yet I don't know, and I would be curious, are there any obstacles from, in terms of what the state has to offer or does that either prevent or in any way hinder benefits to post-secondary or higher education for guard members or in other words, could we be doing a better job in terms of benefits vis-a-vis education?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Galizio, right now the state of Oregon is, like I said, we've been kind of working with the legislative in the governor's office to find areas where there's problems and tweak them. You will see in the House side of, probably fairly soon some legislation that talks about, you know, correcting languages for annual training, for instance, and this has been a major issue. The bill was, I can't give you the bill number, but it's coming up here real soon. I think I just got a copy of it yesterday. It changes terms, and some of this is how people interpret what's currently in the law. And we've tried very diligently to make that as clear as we can, and we're seeking some changes in those legislations. The term that always becomes the state offers in all subdivisions of the state, we have statutory language that allows, if you go to your 15 days of annual training, that you are compensated for that. You get your regular salary, it's additional leave, paid leave for guard and reservists. The term annual training has become extremely problematic over the last 3 years since 9/11 because many people were called up not for annual training, but in lieu of annual training. And it became a huge mess with the HR directors through state and local governments. So we're trying to correct that, for example. And there have been incidents in the community colleges, and there have been incidents at the local level and the city-county levels But I said, your orders didn't say annual training. So we have gone back and told if it happens on our side of the tent, which is the guard, we can make our orders say that to get inside that. Well, now we're looking for legislation that says 15 days federal duty, doesn't matter what you call it, you get it. Simplification. That's a good example of what you're looking at. And that is a big issue.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Galizio.
Get that door.
In reference to the educational benefits, currently we're working on legislation to ensure that to enable guardsmen to have 100% tuition. And this is in conjunction with the federal tuition assistance that already occurs. Currently, federal tuition assistance in this current year will pay for 100% of tuition. In the event that that they cut back and it's been anywhere from 75 to 90% to 100% has been fluctuating, is that we would have the opportunity from the state level to make up the difference. And so from an educational point of view, that is a very good benefit for the Oregon National Guard. Additionally, also we have the opportunity of someone who is in the state of Oregon, an out-of-state person, comes into the state of Oregon, if they enlist in the National Guard, they would receive in-state tuition. So those are a couple of the changes that have occurred over recently to allow educational benefits for Guard people.
Mr. Chairman, I might just add to the committee's benefit, last year, federal fiscal year, we put over $5 million of federal tuition support into the state of Oregon. And a good majority of that did go to community colleges. What we found, looking at the profile of our soldiers and airmen who go to college, we have far higher percentage of people who go to community colleges than the four-year university, which, frankly, when we set up several years ago, and Senator Shields is in the House of Representatives, we set up a 90% tuition assistance, but we were thinking four-year institutions at the time, and of course we made it available also for the community colleges, and then we started tracking it and started seeing who was going where. We were surprised to learn, because our money went further when we had state money to make that, and the feds weren't coming in with the money at that point in time. We started realizing we were able to stretch our money further because we were getting so much participation for AA degrees in a two-year institution. So in that respect, now the federal government's picked up 100% of it, we only had to make up in a very few instances where we had to come in and assist them with state money. And that's been a real advantage to us. But it certainly is community colleges seem to be the education mode of choice with our membership.
Colonel, I've already asked that you follow up with Judith and I on a couple issues, and I'd like to add that one to the list, if that's okay.
Yes, sir.
Okay. We've asked several questions, and they've been diverse, but they all kind of set a context in which both Senate Bill 18 and 19, occur, and so this has been very helpful. I'd like to close the hearing on this, recognize that in a couple minutes we'll do work sessions on both of these bills, but I know your schedule's busy, General, so I want to close the hearing on 18 and 19 and open just a brief hearing on, you had testimony in Senate Memorial 1, is that?
That is correct.
Okay, let's open a hearing then, just to take your testimony on Senate Joint Memorial 1.
I'll give you the feedback on those.
I thought it was probably these nice hollow walls.
We don't know what that is, but we're getting feedback around here.
The acoustical treatments in these facilities that were built 50 years ago were not necessarily designed for the optimum.
We
keep it pretty.
It's money, I'm sorry.
With regard to her comment on heat, we've met the enemy and they are us.
I won't say that, sir.
Go ahead, General.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Brigadier General Raymond Byrne, Acting Adjutant General for the Fourth National Guard. With me today is Colonel Mike Caldwell, my Deputy Director. Thank you for your consideration on Senate Joint Memorial 1. The National Guard sits in the United States. Do you want to just turn that one off?
Forward, probably get a feedback out of that.
Any better suggestions?
Yeah, we did.
It's a small run.
Yeah. Okay, we unplugged one of them, so I think we got that kind of
Yeah, I'd be better.
Reintroduce again. I'm Brigadier General Raymond Byrne, Acting Adjutant General of the Oregon National Guard. Thank you for consideration of Senate Joint Memorial 1. The National Guard system in the United States is a rare blend of federal and state systems designed by the nation's founding fathers as a hedge against a large military that could be, if not properly regulated, a deterrent to the liberties of the people. This unique blend of state and federal responsibilities for our nation's military has survived the test of time since before our nation was indeed a sovereign nation. In our nation's Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, under the powers of Congress, we have the following: to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service to the United States, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of officers and the authority of training militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. As the Guard evolved, Congress has provided for the majority of full-time manning for each state. The state has primarily had the responsibility to administer and house the units of the militia. In Oregon, the general fund supports 2% of our total budget, and we earn 1% from armory rentals. The remainder is federally supported, 97%. Unfortunately, the Congress has never seen fit to provide the resources to properly man the Army National Guard's full-time manning requirements. This has caused the states to pick up shortfall or go without the necessary manning to properly administer and train our citizen soldiers. The Air National Guard, in contrast, has chosen a different path and has provided manning for the Air Guard that represents almost a 30% ratio of full-time manning as compared to its total force, to the Guard's 13% against this total force. Additionally, by the Pentagon's own studies, the Army National Guard is presently manned at 58% of the documented full-time manning requirement, 58% of the 100% requirement. Our desire is to raise that 58% mark to 75% of the documented full-time manning requirements as identified by the Pentagon. The results of this lack of full-time manning has become evident as we have deployed over 70% of the total Army National Guard over the past 3 years in support of federal missions. The lack of manning equates to a lack of readiness, which has caused our deployment training time to be extended. This is not what we want, or is it the proper method to prepare soldiers for war. These extended preparation times have major effects on families, employers, and our soldiers, none of which are a good situation for the long-term viability of the Guard. In closing, I again thank you for recognizing our needs at the federal level, and we will answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, General. I'm not going to hold you any longer. I'm sure that Colonel Caldwell can answer questions, and we'll be with
This unique blend of state and federal responsibilities for our nation's military has survived the test of time since before our nation was indeed a sovereign nation. In our nation's Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, under the powers of Congress, we have the following: to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service to the United States, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of officers and the authority of training militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. As the guard of all, Congress has provided for the majority of full-time manning for each state. The state has primarily had the responsibility to administer and house the units of the militia. In Oregon, the general fund supports 2% of our total budget, and we earn 1% from armory rentals. The remainder is federally supported, 97%. Unfortunately, the Congress has never seen fit to provide the resources to properly man the Army National Guard's full-time manning requirements. This has caused the states to pick up shortfall, although without the necessary manning to properly administer and train our citizen soldiers. The Air National Guard, in contrast, has chosen a different path and has provided manning for the Air Guard that represents almost a 30% ratio of full-time manning as compared to its total force, to the Guard's 13% against this total force. Additionally, by the Pentagon's own studies, the Army National Guard is presently manned at 58% of the documented full-time manning requirement, 58% of the 100% requirement. Our desire is to raise that 58% mark to 75% of the documented full-time manning requirements as identified by the Pentagon. The result of this lack of full-time manning has become evident as we have deployed over 70% of the total Army National Guard over the past 3 years in support of federal missions. The lack of manning equates to a lack of readiness, which has caused our deployment of training time to be extended. This is not what we want, or is it the proper method to prepare soldiers for war. These extended preparation times have major effects on families, employers, and our soldiers, none of which are a good situation for the long-term viability of the Guard. In closing, I again thank you for recognizing our needs at the federal level, and we will answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, General. I'm not going to hold you any longer. I'm sure that Colonel Caldwell can answer questions and will be with us a while longer. Is that right?
That's right. I'll be here to help you.
Okay. With that, I'm going to temporarily close the hearing on SJR 1. And what I want to do is open a work session on Senate Bill 18. Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate Bill 18 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue by a clear reference.
Senator George has moved Senate Bill 18 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and he has stipulated that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Gary, I'd like you to call the roll for the record.
Senator George?
Aye.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Aye. The motion, having received a majority, is declared passed. I'd like to close the work session on Senate Bill 18 and open a work session on Senate Bill 19. Senator George, a motion, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It is my pleasure to move Senate Bill 19 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and also to be bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
We'll get our script down here further into the session, I'm sure. Senator George has moved Senate Bill 19 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Again, Gary, I'd like you to call the roll for the record.
Senator George?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator
Walker? Aye.
Senator
Hill? Aye. Senate Bill 19, having received the required majority, is declared passed. I want to close the work session on Senate Bill 19 and reopen the hearing on Senate Joint Memorial 1 since we have begun that. Let's just continue that and conclude it, and then we'll return to the agenda. Is there anyone else, or Mike, do you want to make any comments on Senate Joint Memorial 1? Okay. Do we have people in the audience that would like to comment on Senate Joint Memorial 1? Welcome to the Senate General Government Committee. Would you please state your name for the record this morning?
Yes. Chairman Shields and committee, my name is Mike Sullivan. I'm a lobbyist for AWPPW, which is a union. I'm a veteran. I've spent 4 years, 3 days, 7 hours, 31 minutes and 17 seconds in the United States Navy. I've sat in on a lot of the Veteran Affairs meetings that has been chaired by Representative Nelson. It's gratifying to see the work being done by that committee and the start of this one here. And I'm here really to make a request that in these joint memorials that the issue of the mandatory funding, thank you very much, for federal VA be sent with our delegation that goes to the Congress and the Senate. For me, I think it's ludicrous that every year the VA has to literally beg for funding. To me, the VA is part of the war. It's an afterthought. My concern is, that in this zenith of time of concern of our soldiers, Navy, Air Force, and Marines, that it will rain in time that people will forget. And going with the VA over the years, because I am service connected, I'm 30%, there have been long lines. It's hard to staff because they don't know what their budget is annually. And I think it's time that if we ask people, young people, that are like women, the citizens of this country, that we as citizens should honor them as veterans and take care of them adequately. And really, that's all the remarks I have to make. I apologize, it isn't written, but I've just gotten a shot 2 weeks. And we do need that, I think, very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there any other testimony on Senate Joint Memorial 1? We will consider what you're saying, even though we don't have any way to deal with it right now, given that we have bills, but we will keep your testimony in mind. I would like to close the hearing on Senate Joint Memorial 1 and open a work session on Senate Joint Memorial 1. I think I should before we do this. Let's, it was suggested to me that I should just read into the record for all of us the language of the joint memorial. And you've heard the General's testimony. To the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America, in Congress assembled, and to the Secretary of Defense, we, your memorialists, the 73rd Legislative Assembly of the State of Oregon, in legislative session assembled, respectfully represent as follows. Whereas the Army National Guard has been called to federal active duty in numbers not seen since World War II, and whereas the Oregon Army National Guard has provided 70% of its units to Operation Enduring Freedom and to Operation Iraqi Freedom, and whereas for decades full-time manning of the Army National Guard has been underfunded and woefully neglected, and whereas the Army National Guard and the Army Reserve are currently manned at approximately 58%, and whereas it is very difficult when Army National Guard units are manned at 58%, for units to maintain readiness requirements and to carry out their mission to serve this nation, and whereas the lack of full-time manning has caused the mobilization process to be extended, resulting in a longer deployment cycle for members of the Army National Guard, now therefore be it resolved by the Legislative Assembly of the State of Oregon that we, the members of the 73rd Legislative Assembly, respectfully request that the Congress of the United States and the Secretary of Defense authorize and appropriate funding
to attain 75% of the full-time manning requirements for the Army National Guard, and that the Secretary of Defense report to Congress in the 2005 fiscal year on a plan to meet 100% of full-time manning requirements by the end of 2008. And be it further resolved that a copy of this memorial shall be sent to the President of the United States, the Secretary of Defense, and to each member of the Oregon Congressional Delegation. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move that Senate Joint Memorial 1 be moved to the floor with a to be adopted recommendation.
Senator George moves that Senate Memorial 1 be moved to the floor with a to be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yes,
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, the military still hasn't figured out about gender diversity. They talk about manning requirements. I thought we should be changing that to staffing requirements, but the military still calls it manning, so we'll stay with that. And then secondly, I think what Mr. Sullivan testified about is extremely critical. And while it cannot be amended into this joint memorial, I would ask that this committee take a look at introducing its own joint memorial because we are woefully underfunding the VA and the services that these service people need when they come out of their service for this country. And I think that would be a great memorial for this committee to put forward.
Thank you, Senator Walker. That's essentially what I said, though you said it much more eloquently. And I would like maybe for you folks to meet with us afterwards, Judith, maybe do that following the hearing. Is there any other discussion? Senator Virgin.
Aaron, I just want to make a comment to the committee. I have always worried about the memorials being sent in with so many other memorials that they don't get the kind of attention that we want them to get. I don't know the answer to that or the solution, but I think that in the years that I've been in the legislature, I've seen some very serious issues being sent under memorials and resolutions that I felt like didn't get as much attention. So I would just ask that the committee give some thought to how we can put more teeth into these memorials that when they arrive at their destination, people take them as seriously as we intended when we sent them.
And this has been a frustration of mine since I arrived in 1992 in the House. I'm sure all of us feel the same way. Anybody have any bright ideas? Don't be afraid to come to us. Maybe we should find a new delivery system somehow.
Mr. Chair, and I honestly am not remembering the exact memorial, but at one point in time, I know that the legislature had passed one, and it just so happened that maybe a week or two later, there was a delegation of legislative members that were going back to Washington, D.C., and instead of kind of put them in the mail and addressing them, we hand-delivered a number of memorials, at least to the Oregon delegation. So
maybe
that's one way to make sure that they get into members' hands, but clearly it's not always possible.
Maybe we need to have that kind of redundant methodology where we mail them and the next legislative delegation goes to D.C. also hand delivers them. That would be one methodology. Is there any other discussion? We've had the motion before us. We've discussed it. So I'm going to ask Gary if he'll call the roll on the Senate Joint Memorial 1.
Senator George.
Aye.
Senator Todd.
Aye.
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 Senate Joint Memorial 1, having received a majority, is declared passed. And with that, the hearing on Senate Joint Memorial 1 is closed. I do want to say to everybody for the record that it would be wonderful if we were always this unanimous in this committee, but that seems to happen more around such important issues as this than a lot of the other issues that we have. I'm going to now open a hearing that may show some of our concern a little more on Senate Bill 223.
this is the only one for which we have multiple people signed up to testify, and so we're going to have some serious testimony coming, but I'm going to ask Judith if she'll set a context before we begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate Bill 223 increases the maximum veterans' home loan amount to 100% of net appraised value on homes that are real property. It applies to home loan applications on or after the effective date of the Act. If you will notice on the bill itself, the change happens on the first page, line 27, where the increase is from 97 to 100% of net appraised value that's eligible for the loan amount. We have received a no fiscal impact and a no revenue impact statement on this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Judith. I appreciate that. I'm going to call the folks from the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs to come to dais together. I have three of them signed up here, Paula Brown, Donna Latterman, and Bruce Shriver. Did I mess up anybody's name too badly? Okay. I'll let you go in the order in which you wish to go. We're still having some trouble with feedback. I don't know if that's because I sit too close. It seems when I back up, I get more feedback, so I don't know what to do. Whoever would like to begin, I think we'll take the testimony from everybody that's at the desk, and then we'll ask all those questions together. So make notes of questions that you might have, okay?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Paula Brown. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm pleased to be here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 223, which was pre-session filed by the Governor on behalf of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. Jim Willis, the Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, would like to have been here to testify on this bill. However, he was unable to. He has the privilege today of presenting a Purple Heart to a Vietnam veteran, and at the request of Representative Donna Nelson, who chairs the House Veterans Affairs Committee, that presentation is occurring on the floor of the House of Representatives, and may be occurring as we speak. Accompanying me today are Bruce Shriver, our Department Chief Financial Officer, and Donna Lanterman, the Department's Home Loan Origination Manager. They accompanied me should there be questions that specifically affect their areas. Also today, I would like to acknowledge that Walter Cruz, a member of the Governor's Veterans Affairs Advisory Committee, is in the audience and I believe will also provide testimony to the committee. The Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs has been making home loans to qualified veterans since 1945. When the department was created by the Oregon legislature to offer home loans to World War II veterans and to ensure that those returning World War II veterans were obtaining the benefits to which they were entitled as a result of their military service to a grateful state and nation. Since 1945, the department's made more than 333,000 home loans with a positive economic impact to the state of more than $7.4 billion. Senate Bill 223 would allow the Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs to make a home loan up to a maximum of 100% of the net appraised value. Currently, the loans made by the department cannot exceed 97% of the net appraised value. This legislation would give the Director the flexibility of offering an additional loan product to eligible and qualified veterans. It would provide an increased number of Oregon veterans who are already in the existing pool of eligibles with the opportunity to attain homeownership with a low interest rate home loan. It would not increase or enlarge the size of the pool. It would also reduce the upfront cost for borrowers, which is a very important part of this. We often have home loan applicants. Typically, they may be younger families, and they have the demonstrated ability to repay the loan. but they simply don't have that upfront cost for their down payment, so this would help those families. It would also provide borrowers with an additional state home loan product from which that they could choose. There are a number of home loan products available, and this would simply give them another one to choose from. It would also make additional loan products available to the mortgage and lenders. The department enjoys a relationship with a network, a statewide network of lenders and brokers who are approved to originate or the Department of Veterans Affairs state home loans, and this would give them another loan product that they could offer to their clients. It's certainly been a relationship that we have enjoyed with these important business partners. And I should add, very importantly, that the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs would requires that mortgage default insurance on any loans in excess of 80% loan-to-value ratio. This insurance protects the department should those loans be defaulted on. In addition to requiring the mortgage insurance, the department's underwriting guidelines are much more stringent now than they were in years past. And the department's home loan policies are in line with Fannie Mae guidelines. And for me, that concludes my testimony. I certainly appreciate having had the opportunity to testify before this committee and answer any questions that you might have.
Are there questions by the committee? Mm-hmm. Yes, Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Brown answered some of them as she testified. My question is, basically, is there no down payment loans, correct?
Chair Shields, Senator Walker, yes, that is correct. Currently, borrowers have to have a 3% down payment. At that time, they would not. They would still have their closing fees, but they wouldn't have to have that 3% down payment.
Well, that was my next question, Mr. Chair. Do you finance the closing costs, or is that required to be paid at the time of the loan?
Chair Shields, Senator Walker, I will let Donna Lantern, our loan origination manager, answer that question for you.
Good morning, Chairman. And Senator Walker, committee members, for the record, my name is Donna Lantern. I represent the loan department as the loan origination as their manager. In answer to your question, the closing costs are not included in their payment. They have to come up with the closing costs.
Okay.
Forgive me, I have a cold.
Mr. Chair, I have one more question. I was glad to see that you require mortgage insurance because these are a little bit more high-risk loans when you have that loan-to-value with such a gap. And my question is, though, because mortgage insurance is very expensive, at what point do you allow a borrower to stop carrying mortgage insurance? Is it at the point where they are at that 80% loan-to-value? And do you reassess that, or do they have to monitor that?
Chairman, Senator Walker, in answer to that question, at what point is that your question? If they want to, and they have proven that they've got at least 20% into it, we will entertain or look at their situation, see whether or not that makes sense to do. Typically, though, at 78% is a requirement that we release them of mortgage insurance.
So, Ms. Chair, you have then a process where you go through and periodically check your loans to make sure that at the 78% mark you release one from that. Okay, great. And I've got, there is one last question. What is your default rate on your loans? Is it about average?
Chair Shields, Senator Walker, I will let our Chief Financial Officer so everybody do get a chance to get a day. Thank you.
For the record, my name is Bruce Schreiber. I'm the Chief Financial Officer of the Oregon Department of Business Affairs. Actually, our default rate is below industry average.
Oh, great. I didn't know. Thank you.
Bruce, I'd like to push you a little farther on that. You say it's below the national average. What is that average, and what are you?
Chairman Shields, that's pretty.
our total delinquency is about 1.5% as far as loans and foreclosure, which are included in that percentage. We're about 0.2. In comparison, the last comparison that I saw, the total delinquency in Oregon, they had a representative sample of servicers in Oregon. The conventional, I believe, was about 1.8 total delinquency, and the in comparison to FHA and VA loans, those percentages are around 3% or higher.
So it's 1.5 versus 1.8 for the average, and for the default part, it was
0.2 to 0.3.
Yeah. Is that right? I'll let you verify it if you want. Looks like you got enough papers to verify just about anything in the world. You might be a military vehicle to haul that thing back out of the building.
Chair Shields, yes, my right arm is getting a little stronger than the left. I have some stats here, at least through the first quarter of 2004. And this is another slightly different cut. So the items that we view as the most seriously delinquent or concerned, the non-performing type loans, we were at 0.38, and that's 90, delinquency that are 90 or more days old, or then foreclosure at 0.38. Conventional loans were more than 0.63, and the FBA was 3.25. I'm sorry, that was FBA, and the FHA was 3.94.
Sounds like they're doing pretty well.
It does, Mr. Chair.
I do have a contextual question. It sounds like you've tightened up operations a lot. I just happen to be such an old codger that I remember the 80s. Do you want to comment on some of the learnings since that time and how you want to make absolutely certain nothing like what happened back then happens again if you move to this frontier? That's part of it. That's the first question. I guess I'll just hold the second question.
Okay, Chair Shields, I can certainly understand your bringing that forward, and made sure that I had exactly the person here that was going to be able to give you an answer on that. And
let's move the microphone to the middle. It'll pick up a little bit better on our recording equipment.
Chairman Shields.
That's fine. That's so sensitive. I'm going to pick you up, though.
There are a couple key differences. If I can compare, especially the very early 80s, late 70s, to where the department is now. Paula did comment a bit on that. But the primary difference, or the key difference, is that the loans, the lower down payments, do require this mortgage insurance. The loans that were being made in the late 70s, very early 80s, the department required no mortgage insurance at all. So the department bore the entire risk of any loan default. The mortgage insurer wasn't in there to help us hedge our loss or mitigate our loss. Secondly, as Paula had mentioned, is that the underwriting standards back then did not follow line by line by all the industry guidelines. They weren't tied to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac underwriting guidelines. So some of the underwriting may have been a bit more lenient or lax than what's in place currently. And thirdly, the other thing that really happened back there too was that Oregon really got slammed with a pretty big recession in those early 80s.
I'm not sure I want to compare the recessions of the 80s to today's economy. That might not be very beneficial. But I do remember back then I was still young enough to run marathons every year and all of that stuff, and I wasn't paying that much attention to politics. I lived in Klamath County, a long ways from here. But
I do remember it was in the papers a lot, and it was fairly scandalous, you know, and it sounds like you've taken a lot of learnings from that so that you're covered every which way. And I guess my question is, if we move in this direction, you're able to pretty much guarantee that we won't have any kind of replay of that kind of event, and even if you have the faults, you've got the insurance which you didn't have before.
So, Shields, I've learned over the years to never say never, but yes, we're highly confident that we have covered our risks pretty well.
I realize that some members of the committee may not be as familiar, and just for the record, could you give us a very brief description of what happened back then?
Sir Shields, members of the committee, Oregon, also, I'm going to go back to about the late 70s, maybe 1978, 1979. The economy was cooking pretty good. Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs was making loans.
Let's move the microphone to the middle. It'll pick up a little bit better on our recording equipment.
Jim Shield.
That's fine. That's so sensitive. It'll pick you up there.
There are a couple key differences, if I can compare, especially the very early 80s, late 70s, to where the department is now. Paul did comment a bit on that. But the primary difference, or the key difference, is that the loans, the lower down payments, do require this mortgage insurance. The loans that were being made in the late 70s, very early 80s, the department, required no mortgage insurance at all. So the department bore the entire risk of any loan default. The mortgage insurer wasn't in there to help us hedge our loss or mitigate our loss. Secondly, as Paul had mentioned, is that the underwriting standards back then did not follow line by line by all the industry guidelines. They weren't tied to like Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac underwriting guidelines. So some of the underwriting may have been a bit more lenient or lax than what's in place currently. And thirdly, the other thing that really happened back there too was that Oregon really got slammed with a pretty good recession in those early 80s.
I'm not sure I want to compare the recessions of the 80s to today's economy. That might not be very beneficial. But I do remember back then I was still young enough to run marathons every year and all of that stuff, and I wasn't paying much attention to politics. I lived in Klamath County, a long ways from here. But I do remember it was in the papers a lot, and it was fairly scandalous, you know, and it sounds like you've taken a lot of learnings from that so that you're covered every which way. And I guess my question is, if we move in this direction, you're able to pretty much guarantee that we won't have any kind of replay of that kind of event, and even if you have defaults, you've got the insurance which you didn't have before.
So, Shields, I've learned over the years to never say never, but yes, we're highly confident that we have covered our risks prudently.
I realize that some members of the committee might not be as familiar, and just for the record, could you give us a very brief description of what happened
back then.
Sir Shields, members of the committee. Oregon, also, I'm going to go back to about the late 70s. So maybe 1978, 1979. The economy was cooking pretty good. Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs was making loans at a quite high rate. In fact, I heard a statistic. I never got it confirmed by a second source, but I heard in 1980 we were the single largest mortgage originator in the United States. $1.2 billion of bonds were issued in 1 year in 1980. So,
nationally, we were the biggest?
I heard that. I did not. Yes, that was the reference that was being made. I didn't ever see an independent source. I just put that back in there. But I just put it in context, the Department was making a lot of loans.
By comparison, what's the volume today?
I think last year we made about $14 million in loans.
$14 million versus
$1.2 billion.
Different world. Okay, thank you.
So again, a lot of loans being made, and that recession, and again, the underwriting criteria may not have been as tight as it maybe should have been, and then that recession hit very hard in the early 1980s. A lot of people lost their jobs.
How many lost their homes and how much financial damage? Go ahead.
Chairman Shields, I did scan back through some of the delinquency statistics. At one time, the delinquencies exceeded 14% of the loan portfolio versus less than 1.5 we have now. I recall looking at those statistics that we had repossessed property, but properties that went all the way through the foreclosure process that we had to take back in. At one time there was over 1,500. So we took a pretty good hit back then. And again, when it really amplified it is that for every dollar of loss, the department bore the loss, there was no mortgage insurance. So there was no buffer there. So that was pretty tough times, but I think a number of good lessons were learned.
I just have to ask this question. Where were, I'm sure some of us were watching this fairly closely. Were all committee members at that time paying attention to this news? I just was wondering.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I had written a note to Senator Starr saying you were probably too young to remember all that. He basically told me that he's been around the process since 1987. So he was the only one I suspected that may not have been old enough.
I wasn't old enough to pay that much attention in the late 70s or early 80s, but the aftermath in the late 80s and the cleanup,
you remember the cleanup.
I've been watching this process. Speaking of the department's come a long way. No question about it.
Speaking of cleanup, what had to be cleaned up? And how did you do that? I know I'm making you live some old stuff that you might not want to, but go ahead.
Churchfield, I'll share what I recall. Yeah, I came in the mid-80s. I wasn't there during the early 80s, so some of this, again, is just from what I heard. Again, we tightened up, made a major effort to tighten up the underwriting guidelines, tying to an industry standard involving the mortgage insurance. We also had to that inventory of real estate owned or state owned property we had to dispose of that. And that took some efforts. We re-emphasized staff-wise more on the collection efforts. I think before the thrust of the department had been more on make the loan, and maybe not enough effort had gone into training all the staff about comp collection
that's really been emphasized. We work very closely with State Treasurer's Office.
Well, given that you ended up owning a fair amount of housing, the voters, the citizens of Oregon, did they take a hit financially, or were you able to recoup the losses with resales and all that stuff? How'd that work out?
There were losses borne by the department.
When you say the department, does that mean the taxpayers?
No.
Okay, that's what I'm trying to separate the two.
No, the GO pledge, I guess, has never had to be used to bail out the department.
Good. I kind of wanted that on the record. Thank you. Are there other questions? Senator Wood.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just having trouble getting my arms around what you're saying. I mean, you say 14%, you know, that was, and now it's 1.3% of what? I mean, that doesn't mean anything to me when you say that. When you talk about the collections, I don't mean this as a criticism. It could be just my own ability to really truly get to the heart of your testimony. When you say, well, there were losses and we've helped our collections, what does that mean? What do you do today? What are your collections? I think I'm trying to get you to be a little bit more specific for me.
Just fill in some gaps.
Senator Wiggin. The percentage that I was quoting is the percentage of those loans that are delinquent versus the total loan portfolio. So like if we had 100 loans, currently 1.5 of those loans would be delinquent. So that percentage that I was quoting, 14% versus the 1.5.
Right, right. I understand that. So what is your total portfolio so that I understand what the 1.5 is?
Currently, it's about 9,000 loans.
9,000.
And so in raw data, 1.5% of that 9,000 loans would be, help me out with my math, Senator Walker.
That's not good enough.
135. Okay. As opposed to how many did you have back then with this $1.2 billion? Go ahead.
I think when the statistics had about 14% or in excess of 14, I think the loan portfolio was approximately 120,000 to 130,000 loans, somewhere in that range.
Different world.
Mm-hmm.
And 14% of that, I'm not going to do the math. I'm sure Senator Byrd can if he wants. Senator Byrd,
140 million. Wasn't really the problem in addition to, well, I'm used to deal with what I believe is a real problem. I lived through that. I know that we were paying interest rates. The interest rates were absolutely unsustainable, and we were passing those on to the folks who were borrowing money for a home loan under the Beckers program. And today, do you think there's more flexibility to adjust and refinance a loan at a lower level? Would, in fact, many of those people have been able to survive if they would have been able to reduce the interest rates? Survive in maintaining their home.
Aaron Shields, Senator George, you were correct. That period of time was a high interest rate period. And again, there were a number of issues. It wasn't, you know, just delinquency. A number of those bond issues were sold at very high rates. And another one of the issues. Some of those loans that were then turned around and lent out to veterans were actually below the cost of the money. So there wasn't what they call a negative spread between what you're earning and what you're paying, which, again, did limit what any real flexibility the department had to try to make adjustments. I mean, the department does try to work with the borrowers, temporary reduction payments, and there's a number of things they do. I think nowadays,
comparing to now. I think we do have bond issues are maybe structured a bit better. There are lower interest rates. And for the borrower and herself, those loan rates are fixed. So they're not subject to having to be raised in case there was a problem. So I think the borrower benefits from that. Did that answer your question, mm-hmm. sir? And Mr. Chairman, if I could.
One more.
That leads me to this issue, and that is the fact that this is a benefit we extend. This is something we're saying to a veteran, listen, we want to give you an additional benefit, and that is the opportunity to own a home. So if, in fact, there is a slight amount of risk involved in that, I still think that's something that society must weigh and say, do we want to do this, even if there is a slight risk or not? When I look at that amount of loss relative to the budgets even then, I realize that that was really pretty minor relative to the sacrifice that was made by those people who received those benefits, and that's just a comment.
Thank you. I have one final question, and that has to do with Oregon relative to other states. Have other states moved to the 100% standard? Are we a pioneer? Are we catching up? Where are we in relationship to the others?
Chairman Sheeran, there's four other states that have a state veterans lending program, and then almost all the other states have a housing type program. Many of those have moved to 100%. Well, there's some sort of insurance. Like, for instance, our counterpart down in Texas, they permit 100% lending. But again, they require insurance. Now, they've teamed up.
Isn't this kind of a national standard, the mortgage default insurance kind of program? Isn't that pretty standard across the whole mortgage industry?
Chairman Shields, yes. I'm not sure I can think of anybody who is not using that for high loan-to-value loans. I will say certain insurance products don't go to 100% currently. One of the products that is used by some housing entities is they utilize what they call FHA insurance, Federal Housing Administration insurance, as insurance for. They only offer that insurance up to 97%, but over this last year they've been having debates and discussions, and bills have been introduced about move it to 100%. So, you know, again, if this particular bill will allow that, the department, if in fact one, it wanted to use FHA insurance, at the point in time FHA insurance did go to a full 100%, it could use that option. Currently the Fed VA loan guarantee allows you to borrow 100%. And in fact, the state of Texas Veterans Program, about 75-80% of their loan volume is tied in with this Fed VA guarantee, basically the 100% loan-to-value ratio. About 75-80% of their loan volume is using that insurance.
Okay. Senator Berger has another question.
Yes. Could you tell me, you have 9,000, how many veterans are eligible for the loan, because everyone doesn't use that eligibility, and how many years after they are served are they eligible?
John Chu, Senator Ruger. We have about, well, currently under Oregon law and under federal law, for our type of loan, you have to apply within 30 years of your leaving of active duty. So, you know, almost all the Vietnam veterans, almost all of them are no longer eligible. So really we're talking about people who have served in Kosovo, Panama, Afghanistan, Iraq. That pool, the last set of statistics I saw from the Fed VA, I think the Gulf War era, veterans potentially were around 60,000 in Oregon.
You say 60?
in Oregon. But again, many of those have already have a home. And obviously not all of them are going to apply.
Sure.
Okay. Using National Guard as we have instead of regular Army and an older person sometimes, a lot of them would have homes before they ever become the veteran of a foreign war or whatever, and so that changes your equation too, the universe in which you're working. Okay. Yes.
If I might, if the committee would allow, I would like to add just one thing to the previous answer that was provided to Senator Verger concerning the collections. I was sitting here thinking of some of the things we've actually done when we say we work with collections. And some of those are, we are very responsive to when the delinquencies occurs. We almost always try to have a face-to-face where we actually have a person go out. Sometimes a person may be late on their payment, and it's not an easy thing to talk about. But sometimes if we have somebody that can go out and talk with them and try to find out what the circumstances are, it could be declining health, it could be a number of things. And if that's occurring, try to take a look at, are there veterans' benefits to which they may now be entitled, because perhaps what previously was a 0%, 10%, 20% service connection disability has now worsened, and we need to get a claim then to try and increase that, which increases their financial health. With those additional dollars coming in, perhaps that can help them with the loan. So those are some of the things that we try to make sure that we do, because, as our borrowers get older, or, you never know what kind of things happen. Things happen in life. So
thank you. Home ownership is very, very important. Particularly those who serve in public life, because we see how it builds community and how it helps neighborhoods, and how so many of the things that are negative that impact us are helped by home ownership. And certainly helping veterans have homes would be extremely important. On the flip side of that, we never want a lot of money owed that needs to be collected. So we are stewards of that fund, as well as promoters of home ownership. So that's my position, and thank you for giving me an opportunity to explain that.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had one question, and then when Ms. Brown just spoke, another one came to my mind. And I appreciate that you go out and meet with the mortgagee, because that's really important. And that last part you talked about is really important for this committee to understand about service-connected disability. My father-in-law was 40% service-connected from World War II. He'd lost his leg. I never knew in all those years. I've been married to my husband 30 years, so I never knew that you could reapply for your a greater service-connected disability, because as you age and when you lose a leg, it creates major problems with your body. No one had ever advised him that he could ever do that. So when he got to the point where he went into assisted living and we were getting his connected disability to 100%, which he was actually eligible at least 2 years prior to that because of his health, I made a point of telling my Congressman DeFazio that he needs to put that information out in his newsletter to veterans. And I hope that it sounds like you're doing that as well, for veterans to reapply if they have a change in circumstances in their health, because that can be a tremendous asset to them to get what the government is willing to pay them if you can show that. Isn't that correct?
Chair Shields, Senator Walker, you're absolutely correct. And often, too, I'll just add to that, I think one of the things that you said, what the government owes to them, mm-hmm. It is an entitlement, and it's not uncommon, especially with World War II veterans, to feel like if they access a benefit to which they are entitled and earned, they might be taking it away from another veteran. So it's not uncommon for the amputee or somebody who has some other disability, which has worsened, because obviously it does go to other things. Sometimes it starts with the ankle, the knee, and onto the hip. that they won't apply for those. But that's a very good suggestion, and I would certainly think that it would be a good idea for the department to put that in our newsletter. And our newsletter currently has a distribution of approximately 70,000 in the state, and that would be an excellent article also for...
Mr. Chair, Ms. Brown, I really would like you to do that. I just think it would be a tremendous benefit, and you're right. An amputee, I mean, he ended up with cardiovascular issues, and he died at 83, and he could have had a longer life, but because he's an amputee, it decreased his lifespan. But that is a tremendous asset, and these people are entitled to this money. And you're right, World War II veterans won't ask for it. They come from a different time where they don't accept handouts, and they view that as a handout, even though it really is an entitlement. So I would really hope that you follow up on that suggestion. Now, in fact, Mr. Chair, my last question, which was really my first, could you just tell us what the average monthly cost of mortgage insurance is for people so we have an idea what that adds to their loan amount? And it varies by the amount you borrow, I understand, but...
Mr. Chair, yeah. Mr. Chair, we could do a scenario if you'd like. I could quickly calculate it for you. It kind of depends on how much they are going to put down. It changes as it goes up. For example, if they put 15% down versus 10% down, there's a difference in what that mortgage insurance fee is going to be.
Let's assume 0% down, because that's what you're asking for in this bill. So let's assume 0% down, 100% loan to value at the average cost of a home today in Oregon.
What would be the difference?
Thank you for the question, Senator Walker.
They also have the opportunity to pay. There's different types of premiums that they can go with. They can pay it all up front. But again, that's a cost, and the idea is not to do that. The average or industry standards is to a monthly premium, which is wonderful. It's a little higher premium, but it allows people to not have to come up with the money to save. Because it becomes part of your closing costs. This way it does not if you do it monthly. This may make your heart stop because of the amount, but I used a $150,000 loan amount, and we can use any amount you'd like. The premium monthly on that is going to be around $125,000.
An annual amount of
which works out to about $2,100 a year.
Now
that goes down as it, you know, it's based on the balance.
Does it go down as you get closer to 80%?
Yeah.
So say you had 85% on that $150,000 house, what would it then be?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the mortgage payment on the $150,000.
$175 in addition.
The insurance payment is $175 a month.
Above
for the mortgage insurance to insure these folks that they don't get stuck with the default.
And the mortgage is on top of that.
And the mortgage is on top of that. Well, lots of things are on top of that. The reason I asked for the annual is that it seems to me that this would be held in escrow and probably be an annual premium payment in some circumstances. At least some mortgage companies do.
That may calculate out differently, but I'm quoting to you the monthly, and again, there's three or four scenarios you could use. Using 150, this is why the more money a person can put into it, the easier it is. And I'm trying not to stall. Forgive me, I forgot to say
that. That's okay, don't worry about it.
If a person has more into it, it's a lot less expensive on the monthly end. What we're finding and why we've gone to the industry, why they've gone to higher or less down, and having this protection mortgage insurance allows them to do that. There was a time when you and your parents, rather, would have this opportunity. They had to save the 20% down. There was no mortgage insurance. When they developed the mortgage insurance, that allow these people to come up with these higher principal balances. Now, in doing so, yes, that mortgage insurance has gone up. Giving an example then, if they were to put 15% down in the same scenario, their monthly payment would be increased by a mortgage insurance premium of $43.75.
It's $43 you're paying for mortgage insurance on a $150,000 home each month. But if you're at 100%, it's going to be $175. That's the motivation to get down to that mandatory 78% or 80% or whatever to get out from under the mortgage insurance.
That's correct. We also, having, Mr. Chair, having us have the opportunity to offer 100% loan. If you've heard of any of these loans out there, they have piggyback loans. Piggyback loans allow us, it would be less, and honestly, it'd be less risk to our department because we, again, the brokers and the lenders do a lot of these loans where the first mortgage will be an 80% and then they will take back a second. We would be in first position, therefore our risk would be a lot less.
Yeah.
And it gives the option to the borrower to do both ways. Right now, they don't have that option. That's why we're asking for it. Not just the 100% programs of traditionally what you think in terms of FHA, which is on the horizon. They currently don't have a 100% program, but it's on the horizon possibly this year. But the federal VA. Thank you.
Thank you for answering all of the questions. I'm going to let you all step back. We have three more people. It's my intention, even though it's noon, to continue this hearing until its conclusion, whether that's in 15 minutes or 45 minutes. I want to continue forward. On my list, I have Walter Cruz, Mike Sullivan, and Donald King listed as wanting to testify. If there's anyone else that's wanting to testify. Do we still have a sign-up sheet back here?
No.
Put a sign-up sheet back there in case there's anyone else that wants to testify. If you want to testify, sign up, please, on this subject or any other subject this morning. I think we had, I can't find my agenda, it's been buried in the rubble, but we had a sense in which we are offering time for public comment, so if you want to testify, you know, either under the heading of public comment or the other, please sign up. Come on up, sir. And what I'm going to try and do now as we try to move toward a conclusion is limit everybody to 5 minutes of testimony on this bill or any other. Is that okay? Thank you. And your name, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Walter Cruz. I'm a Master Sergeant, United States Air Force, retired. I am also the legislative representative for the Non-Commissioned Officers Association.
If you've heard of any of these loans out there, they have piggyback loans. Piggyback loans allow us, it would be less, and honestly, it'd be less risk to our department because we, again, the brokers and the lenders do a lot of these loans where the first mortgage will be an 80% and then they will take back a second. We would be in first position, therefore our risk would be a lot less.
Yeah.
And it gives the option to the borrower to do both ways. Right now, they don't have that option. That's why we're asking for it. Not just the 100% programs of traditionally what you think in terms of FHA, which is on the horizon. They currently don't have a 100% program, but it's on the horizon possibly this year. But the federal VA. Thank you.
Thank you for answering all of our questions. I'm going to let you all step back. We have three more people. It's my intention, even though it's noon, to continue this hearing until its conclusion, whether that's in 15 minutes or 45 minutes. I want us to continue forward.
On my list, I have Walter Cruz, Mike Sullivan, Donald King listed as wanting to testify. If there's anyone else that's wanting to testify, do we still have a sign-up sheet back here?
No.
Put a sign-up sheet back there in case there's anyone else that wants to testify. If you want to testify, sign up, please, on this subject or any other subject this morning. I think we had, I can't find my agenda, it's been buried in the rubble, but we had a sense in which we are offering time for public comment, so if you want to testify, you know, either under the heading of public comment or the other, please sign up. Come on up, sir. And what I'm going to try and do now as we try to move toward a conclusion is limit everybody to 5 minutes of testimony on this bill or any other. Is that okay? Thank you. And your name, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Walter Cruz. I'm a Master Sergeant in the United States Air Force, retired. I am also a legislative representative for the Non-Commissioned Officers Association, and I'm the spokesman for the United Veterans Groups of Oregon, and I'm the chairman of the Legislative Subcommittee for the Governor's Advisory Council to the Director of Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. The main thing I want to do is say that I and those I represent strongly support this Senate Bill 223. And as a little item of note, my son is now in the process of saving up enough money to make the down payment on a home using this Veterans Home Loan Program. He's also retired Air Force. And it would help him if this bill were now the law that he would be able to go ahead and purchase the home that he's saving the down payment for. And I and those I represent would ask that the committee forward this bill to the full Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
We've
had a good examination of the bill this morning, but we appreciate your coming and testifying on it. Are there any questions? If not, we'll ask you to step back. Walter, is Mike Sullivan here? I know that you testified. Okay, yes, you did. Donald King, is Donald here? I guess he's left. Okay, I'm going to ask Gary. We've got two more witnesses that are now signing up. We'll get their names down here. Would the first of those witnesses, whoever signed first, just come forward? Okay, is that you? What is your name, sir?
Good morning. My name is Wayne Harvey. I'm a resident of Beaverton. Good morning, members of the committee. Thank you.
Are you testifying under just general comment or on this home loan?
On this bill.
Okay, 223.
Yes. Thank you for the opportunity. I know I didn't come with any written comments, or I wasn't prepared to do so, but I'm a member of the Disabled American Veterans, the Veterans of Foreign Wars, the Retired Enlisted Association, the American Legion. I'm also a member of the United States Army's Retiree Sub-Council out of Fort Lewis. I retired from the military in 1997 after serving 20 consecutive years. I am 90% service-connected disabled veteran. When I retired in 1997, I remember coming to some committee hearings similar to this with members of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, who I applaud their efforts. At that time, I learned that I couldn't get a home loan in the state of Oregon because I didn't serve in Vietnam. But when I joined the military in 1977, I served 20 consecutive years, and I retired in 1997. But for some odd circumstances, but at that time in 97 and 98, I didn't qualify for the Oregon Home Loan Program because I didn't serve during Vietnam, nor did I ever serve in a combat zone. I was lucky to avoid that. But through their efforts at ODBA, I learned years later that the rules had changed and that I might have qualified now for a home loan. However, the part that concerns me is that when I didn't qualify for an Oregon home loan at the time, I had to use the federal VA home loan. And fortunately, that did allow 100% and also didn't require any down payment, nor did it require any closing cost. So I just walked in, signed my name, and was able to buy a home for my family, which was great. As the rules changed, I was told by the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs home folks that I couldn't participate, as I understand it, in their program unless I got another house. I couldn't, the house that I'm in now, and I wouldn't be able to refinance it through their program. I'd have to wait until I found myself purchasing a new home. Unfortunately, I'm not in a position to be doing that financially to buy a new home. Probably never will. So I'm concerned that this program, although great, will leave me out of, and many veterans like me that are in homes, as you mentioned before in the testimony, they won't be able to participate in order to make use of that benefit. So I just would caution you to consider that maybe some process where folks that are in homes that need that loan can then make use of it somehow. And that's all I wanted to say.
Yeah. Are there questions? You've given us something to think about, and I'm hoping that the department is listening as well as they continue to respond to the needs of veterans. Let's see, Lyle, is it Vaught?
Yes, sir.
Welcome to our committee, Lyle. Are your comments on Senate Bill 223 or just general?
On 223, sir.
Public comment, okay.
My name is Lyle Rove. I live in outside of Newburgh.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a World War II veteran. I've never had a home loan or anything. But in the recent years, two or three years now, I've heard that the Oregon home loan program had been dropped. It was no longer existed. That rumor is still rampant in my region post. And I don't know how to stop it, but I'm sure glad to be here today to hear you, and I hope you pass this thing, because we need it for the other veterans. Not myself. I'm getting too dang old. But I want to say thank you, and I hope you make it work.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate you coming this morning.
Chairman, yes. There's another thing to include in that newsletter. 70,000 people might get it.
Right.
Letting them know that that rumor is just a rumor and it doesn't.
Yeah, I wonder how such a rumor can start when you've given away as many thousands of loans over the years. I guess you'll have to work on that one, and maybe we can find some way to help you work on that one in the days ahead. I am wanting to get a feel of the committee relative to working on this morning or taking it back and doing it at the legislature. And I'm going to be honest, okay, one of the reasons to maybe wait might be that we could get a little more attention to this. You notice how the media always shows up for the first half hour of any hearing, and they all packed up and left. I even noticed the Oregonian Reporter leaving about a half an hour ago. If we're going to do something, and if we want to address the question that's just been raised, maybe we should have a chance to talk a little bit more and bring this back. That'd be my idea. Maybe we could even work out, if this committee would like to join me, we could work out a press conference with the Veterans Affairs folks. I'm not sure. Colonel Caldwell would like to make a comment. Maybe he's a better statistician? Not statistician, a better strategist than I am. So I'm betting you've got some strategy.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Colonel Mike Caldwell with the Oregon National Guard, I applaud your effort to try to get that attention, because I think it's important for all veterans, and as was testified earlier, we're creating a number of veterans right now, obviously, with the call-ups that we've had. But there's another issue that I think you should know as you consider this. If you're a National Guardsman, you can serve, in my case, 34 years. Next month, I finish my 34th year in the Oregon National Guard, and I'm not eligible for these loans. Because Oregon's veteran status is determined by the Constitution, which means you have to have 210 days of federal active duty Title X service.
Consecutively.
Mm-hmm. And in my case, I've got almost 15 years total time of active duty service, but it doesn't count because it wasn't consecutive. It was in CHOPS in 34-year period. Now, that's a lot bigger issue.
That's also a federal issue of arrest.
No, it's not. I qualify for federal, and all guardsmen do after 6 years.
You can.
Yes. So guardsmen have been shoved over, so you've got this, in our case, 7,000 Oregon guardsmen that are technically, unless they get called up for federal active duty.
Let me ask you a question. Is this an appropriate vehicle, and could this vehicle be amended, and would you be willing to work with the VA people around such an amendment? I'm asking a whole bunch of questions at once.
Mr. Chairman, answer your question. I don't think this vehicle would be the right one. No, I think you should move this along. I think it's a topic for another discussion. Mr. Wallace and I have had that discussion. As the governor had originally planned in his package that he's going to release here very soon, in his package for the Guard, the governor was planning on adjusting that, and Mr. Willis and I met with the governor's office last summer to discuss it. Then we realized it was a constitutional issue. It's going to take a constitutional amendment, so it's a horse of a bigger, bigger horse than what we're dealing with here. But I thought if you're going to look for, if this is going to be a focus, and looking at the moody aspects of it and how else you're going to do it to get those folks there, then I think that might be good.
We might dovetail that into at least a media strategy.
Yes, sir.
And when it comes to strategies, if you, again, and some of you folks, the Veterans Home Loan, if you could meet with Judith and myself and Senator George, maybe we can put together a bipartisan press conference and address all these issues at the time of a work session that we would do in this bill, and either proceed the work session with some kind of a press conference or follow the work session with a press conference of some sort. I'm not very good at this stuff. I'm just making some suggestions, and I'll defer to the logic of those of you who've done more than I have.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, the ODBA has a superb public relations staff. They've, under the guidance of Mr. Wells, they have leaned forward on many, many different issues, and I would comment, as far as we're concerned, they're first class, and they've done an excellent job helping us.
You know a lot more about it than I do, and they might have a very classy operation, and that's good. I still want your input.
Yes, sir.
If we can get it. And we still have the problem back here that there's rumors going around Legion Halls and so on that the loan department doesn't exist anymore. So we have some challenges, and I'd just like to pull all that together if we can. Mm-hmm. And Judith will be in touch with y'all.
Well, the good news is that if you ever want a rumor starter, just go to a military bunch.
It's part of the culture.
Mr.
Chairman.
Yes.
That's all. That's why they're always ready to be committed, because they're just anticipating it's going to happen. Mr. Chairman, if I could, relative to postponing and putting a group of issues together, I think it's very important. We have a bill coming. Hopefully the Senate President will allow it to be heard. It's also going to be heard on the House, and that is for us to step up and raise the benefits available for the loss of one of our current serving troops to $250,000. Congress is thinking about doing it. This could be, in fact, an addition to that, and those of us who maintain insurance realize that that's not even today very much insurance. But if we could put these together, it would really be a powerful package to indicate how much we care about them.
It might be that this morning, serendipitously, we've done three bills that need to move forward and can move forward, and this could become part of the second round. And I don't want it to be delayed more than a few weeks. So let's try to see how fast we can get all this pulled together.
Mm-hmm.
because this has been a convincing hearing as far as I'm concerned this morning. Some of my fears, Bruce, I want to say to you that I particularly grilled you this morning because, you know, I remembered the past and I wanted to be disabused of any similarity to the past, and you did a good job at that, and I appreciate that. So I think we've got some stuff. Now, I had one item for the good of the order.
Well, have we closed the hearing on this?
Well, I guess we can close the hearing on Senate Bill 223.
I have a correction.
Oh, okay. We have a correction before we close the hearing. How's that?
I guess I was nervous. I went back and recalculated the 100%. That was 130 a month, not 175.
Okay. Well, that's on the record. But it's still, I mean, 135, when you're 100% versus $43 a month if you're at 85%, so that's...
$43.75.
Boy, now she's close enough for government work, okay? Thank you.
All right. And I changed it in my notes.
and
you want me to calculate?
No, that's enough. Huh?
Yeah.
So the $43.75 was correct?
Yes.
Yes,
okay.
Oh,
boy, are you guys...
$15.60 yearly for the 100%.
What's this?
$15.60 a year at $130 a month.
Okay. $15.60 yearly.
And Chair Schnell, member of the committee, I might share with you that we are certainly willing to do the press releases. We've actually done press releases in the past with letting...
Well, we'll coordinate with you. We would like Colonel Caldwell involved as well. And we need to work it around our Senate schedule as we get the other bill that Senator George referred to, maybe to it at the same time. I don't know. Maybe we want this to stand alone so that it gets more attention. We'll, that's all the strategy that we're asking to work together on.
Sure.
Okay?
Thank you.
I was going to mention something for the good of the order, and I want each of you to pay close attention. We've had some trouble, those of us that are on committees around the Capitol from 1 to 3 and another committee from 3 to 5.
Right.
Frustrating. Because I cannot vaporize in one room and reappear in the other and on time.
Yeah.
So, this is a deal I'm going to make with you. If you will show up promptly at 3:10, our hearings will begin at 3:10 and not at 3 o'clock from now on. But that doesn't mean 3:20 or 3:30, so try to hit it at 3:10 and we'll change that method from now on. Yes, Senator Bruce.
Mr. Chairman, probably for the good of the order in a way, I would not want to recognize the work that Representative Nelson is doing on Veterans Affairs in the House. And I wonder if, as we go forward with some of the ideas on Senate Bill 223, that we might not, in some way, at least have some communication with Representative Nelson.
I think you're right, and I'm going to ask Judith to make sure that on Monday I make contact with Senator Nelson. We've worked together on other things. We've been on some commissions and committees together. So
thank you. I think that would be, she would appreciate it.
Yeah, okay. Very good. If there is no other business, I thank you all for coming, and well, there's two people here. Excuse me, I'm sorry.
There's three.
Three. I thought I did close the public hearing on Senate Bill 223. Well, if I didn't close it, I've now closed the hearing on Senate Bill 223. I want to bring forward the folks that want to talk about the Iraq-Afghan Freedom War Memorial Project. That would be Mr. and Mrs.
Kesterson.
Yeah. And,
And Madeline.
And Madeline. Hello, Madeline. How are you?
We're lucky.
On me.
If we're lucky, she'll be real quiet.
Tell us about it.
Okay. Well, I'd like to tell you a little bit about what motivated us to start this project, and then explain the project itself and a little progress report on how we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
essentially, our son was a Black Hawk pilot that we lost in Iraq in Mosul a year ago last November. Right after that, my wife said that we were going to do something. We didn't know what, but it was going to be big. And to that event, we started researching to find out what it would take to build a memorial for the guys that are going over there and serving now instead of waiting 50 years. First thing we did was went and got a lawyer and established ourselves as a 501c3 nonprofit organization. We got an architect who laid the project out for us. We have I was going to tell you about my son, but we'll just go ahead and tell you about the project instead. This, we've already tentatively been given the land at the Capitol, at the north end of the mall, right at the north end of the Veterans Administration building. I don't know if you're familiar with that area, that park-like area there. Essentially, it's going to be a large waiting pond for kids with a map of the world laid out in it, and then the land masses raised up out of the water. Along the meridians, there will be lighted sprays and fountains for the kids to play in. Then here over America, there's going to be a 6-foot marble pedestal with a life-size bronze soldier mounted on top, and he'll be articulated. He's going to move back and forth, sweeping his arm out in a gesture of offering help to the rest of the world. On the base of the pedestal, the names of all the fallen heroes are going to be, from Oregon, are going to be engraved, and medallions for the different services will be mounted on that pedestal, too. We've already selected the artist that's going to do the sculpture, and she's at work on it now. I have a really fine project manager, Bill McMichaels. He's bringing that 3-story hospital up out of the ground in Newburgh. He's done projects similar to this in Hillsboro. Anyway, he really knows his stuff. He's also been instrumental in getting us quite a bit of in-kind donations in the form of labor and materials to get this project done. Who else? Representative Donna Nelson has joined our board. She's been a big help getting the word out. We've been doing fundraising. We started with the Pendleton Roundup last September. To date, we've raised about $25,000 in cash, along with, I'm guessing approximately $125,000 in in-kind donations. I'm leaving out.
We have 3 fundraisers this weekend. Oh. We discovered that we aren't able to split ourselves quite that far. So we have volunteers manning 2 of the fundraisers. But we have events planned every single weekend all the way through August. And actually, we need corporate support, which we have been continually asking for, and so far nobody has heard us. We also have a request in that people who would like to volunteer to help, we'd be really happy to do that. AMVET stepped to the plate this week in Eugene for us, and State Representative Donna Nelson has stepped to the plate to take over for us at a meeting in McMinnville, which is a rally with all the heads of the different AMVET groups, and she will explain the project as well. We're very close to breaking ground. We would love to be able to do that by November 15, 2005. That would be our son Eric's 2nd anniversary. I know each and every one of you know about Lance Corporal James Lee Moore. We were in Roseburg yesterday to be with his family while they buried that young Marine. This
is an important project because it is a place now for our soldiers who are serving, but also a place for the soldiers who we are losing. And each family, as we tell them about our project, each family that's losing a son in Iraq, and I say a son because so far we haven't lost any daughters. However, we have many of them here in this state serving today, active duty. But each family that knows of this project is not only grateful, but they're impressed with the notion that it's happening now for them to enjoy going forward into the future. And this particular location where the monument is going is really a wonderful spot because the memorial will also be in the company of the Medal of Honor Memorial, World War I, World War II, CLEAR, which was the most recent representation of service to our country and the loss. And our family really hopes to see, after this memorial completed, that this park be turned into some kind of an education and cultural spot for school kids to actually come to, where history will be taught about the different battles. And you know, when you hear about a memorial, it's one thing, but when you're standing in its reverence, it is a whole different feeling and opportunity for us to give back something to our community, to our state, and to educate our children. So with that, I thank you so much, all of you, for the opportunity to speak to you today, and hopefully you'll be able to help us.
Any questions?
Thank you for coming. And Senator Starr, do you have a question?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Yeah. Chair. Thank you for taking on this project, and thank you for the sacrifice that you've had to endure. We appreciate and value that. The question that I have is, what is the total amount that you're looking to raise in order to bring this memorial to fruition?
We're projecting $350,000 to $500,000, but a lot of that is going to be in-kind donations, labor and materials. I've even thought about, we have two combat engineer groups here locally, one National Guard group and one Marine Corps group up in Soldiers Island. And I intend to set up a little competition between those. I've already discussed it with some of these people, and they want to do the excavation, but I don't know how that's going to work out. But as far as materials are concerned, again, my project manager is really well entrenched into the construction industry around the area, and he's pretty confident that he can bring quite a bit of it to us. So
he's also really a retired Marine, so he has a different...
it's just really hard to pin a price on it.
Senator George has a question for you.
Well, it's more of a comment. It was my pleasure last year to actually get to, probably 18 parades supporting our troops. Our desire this year is to do a similar thing, and I would ask all the committee members and to remind us when the parades are occurring in your community, and we'll see if we can't get there, because my thought is that we would do the same thing, not only in support of the troops, but also, if you remember the situation with Colonel Reiser and his family relative to their home being foreclosed on, to do the same thing here. And he's committed that if he is physically able, because he has been ill, that this would be his number one priority, would be to work on this issue. The event that we held, you know, at Albany would be something we would try to duplicate. The idea being is, right now we're pursuing a gamma goat, anybody knows what that is. We have somebody back there knows what it is. And a very unusual looking machine, we're trying to buy that from surplus. We would then repaint it to the appropriate military colors and put it in there as a place, because it has like a big dump box on the back of it, to collect money in the parades directly if the parade officials would allow that. So dump box full of money. People walking along collecting it up and then dumping the back of the gamma goat.
So we're there with you guys. In fact, I'm going to lean on all of my colleagues in the legislature to personally contribute some money.
Thank you, Senator. We really appreciate that. Yeah.
John, I'm familiar with your project and everything, but our meeting post meets with Winston every month, and I've been sure.
So with that, I thank you so much, all of you, for the opportunity to speak to you today, and hopefully you'll be able to help us.
Any questions?
Thank you for coming. And Senator Starr, do you have a question?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for taking on this project, and thank you for the sacrifice that you've had to endure. We appreciate and value that. Question that I have is, what is the total amount that you're looking to raise in order to bring this memorial to fruition?
We're projecting $350,000 to $500,000, but a lot of that is going to be in-kind donations, labor and materials. I've even thought about, we have two combat engineer groups here locally, one National Guard group and one Marine Corps group up at Soldiers Island. And I intend to set up a little competition between those. I've already discussed it with some of these people, and they want to do the excavation, but I don't know how that's going to work out. But as far as materials are concerned, again, my project manager is really well entrenched into the construction industry around the area, and he's pretty confident that he can bring quite a bit of it to us. So.
He's also a retired Marine, so he has a different
Exactly. It's just really hard to pin a price on it right now.
Senator George has a question.
Well, it's more of a comment. It was my pleasure last year to actually get to, probably 18 parades supporting our troops. Our desire this year is to do a similar thing, and I would ask all the committee members and to remind us when your the parades are occurring in your community, and we'll see if we can't get there, because my thought is that we would do the same thing, not only in support of the troops, but also, if you remember, the situation with Colonel Reiser and his family relative to their home being foreclosed on, to do the same thing here. And he's committed that if he is physically able, because he has been ill, that he would, this would be his number one priority, would be to work on this issue. The event that we held, you know, at Albany would be something we would try to duplicate. The idea being is, right now we're pursuing a gamma goat, if you or anybody knows what that is. We think we have, we have somebody back there knows what it is. And a very unusual looking machine, we're trying to buy that from surplus. We would then repaint it to the appropriate military colors and put it in there as a place, because it has like a big dump box on the back of it, to collect money in the parade directly if the parade officials would allow that. So
dump box full of money.
People walking along collecting it up and then dumping the back of the gamma goat. So we're there with you guys. In fact, I'm going to lean on all of my colleagues in the legislature to personally contribute some money.
Thank you, Senator. We really appreciate that. Yeah.
I'm familiar with your project and everything. But our Legion Post meets with Wednesday every month, and I can sure with the commanders on when you let you explain to them. And I'm sure you'll get a donation. I don't know how much, but I'm pretty sure you'll get a donation.
No, we'd be real happy to make a presentation at your post with
every month.
I don't think that would have been picked up on the record, but it's indicative of a show of support that I'm sure a lot of posts would have. And so I thank you for that comment, and I thank you for your presentation. Keep us apprised. We'll do what we can. We know that you've obviously been in contact with Judith to get this on the agenda today, so keep us apprised. And if there is not any other comment from any corner of the room, I'm going to both close the hearing on the Afghan-Iraqi Freedom War Memorial Project, and I'm going to close this hearing of the Senate Committee on General Government and adjourn. Thank you very much.